Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the dawn of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. Welcome to another edition of BOA Audio Season 8 Live. And we're welcoming back a friend of the program. He was on actually a little over a year ago. I was just looking at it now. He was on May 20th, 2013, so now he's back here on June 3rd, talking about Dr. Tyler Kochjohn. He is a professor of microbiology at the Arizona College of Osteopathic Medicine, and he's an adjunct senior scientist at Banner Sun Health Research Institute. He's also a keen observer and student of the world of the paranormal. So he's one of those rare folks who is in academia who will actually say they are interested in the paranormal, and we'll talk about it. So that's what we're going to be doing here tonight, talking about how to apply science to the paranormal and really just kind of having a jam session, because the last time he was on the show was an epic edition of the program. Ran over 3 hours. It was just an absolute marathon, and I really enjoyed talking to him quite a bit, so I wanted to get him back here on the live show. So welcome back to the show, Dr. Tyler Kochjohn.
Hey, thanks, Tim.
I guess, you know, let's start off sort of just, we've done the bio background on you before, and folks can hear that on the previous edition of the show that you were on. You know, what have you been up to in the last year as far as in the realm of the paranormal? I know you're, as I said at the beginning here, you're a keen observer of all this. So has anything piqued your interest, I guess you could say, you know, in the last 12 months or so?
Oh, my God, there's always something going on. Well, you know, I think we were talking last year about Bigfoot quite a bit, and that sort of, I guess, kind of tapered off a little bit, although Rick Dyer tried.
Yeah.
But the thing that has really kind of caught me in terms of DNA work and paranormal phenomena or phenomena thought to be paranormal, the Paracas skulls has been kind of interesting, and I'm awaiting more data from that particular group, and thinking that, you know, perhaps they will come forward with something that we can parse and argue about. Haven't seen anything yet, and so far, you know, they've gotten a long way with very little data that they'll show.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether those skulls are human or something other, be quite fascinating, and perhaps DNA will help us figure that out.
Well, it's interesting. We, as I said, we talked like in May, and after that, all that DNA stuff did kind of shake out as far as the Bigfoot research that was being done over there in the UK. So it's kind of interesting, and I saw you did a blog post for our mutual friend Jeremy Vaney's blog, JVay. I always get it mixed up. It's J-A-Y-V-A-Y. Just about how once science gets involved in a lot of this, sometimes these stories fall apart. Like the one about they thought it was some kind of missing link type thing, and it turned out it was an African person. This was like a long time ago. I forget the name of the story. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, not offhand. You're not talking about Piltdown Man or anything, are you?
No. I'm talking about I don't have it in front of me here, but yeah, it was. I'm trying to remember it now. Yeah, I don't recall it off the top of my head, but
Okay.
So I'll Zana, I think it was Zana or something like that. Zana?
No, it doesn't ring a bell.
Okay. Well, it's just interesting that the more you the more you apply the science to it, these things just fall apart. That's kind of the point I was trying to make, just that, you know, it really separates the myth and legend from the fact once you can actually apply some kind of testing to it.
It can. Sometimes there's an art of interpretation that the sequences may or may not be definitive. A great example of that is the Star Child, where Lloyd Pye had, and I give him credit, he had tried to use what I think was the best possible tool, which was to do DNA sequence analysis of basically sequences extracted from the bone.
Hmm.
Now, his data that he got, I would not have interpreted it the same way as Mr. Pye. And he saw it as earth-shaking evidence for some kind of otherworldly origin for the Star Child, and I looked at it and said, "Now you know what? This is an artifact. This is an artifact of basically storage and age. DNA has kind of characteristic ways it falls apart. His sequence was wrong because he had a stop code on in there."
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, just kind of didn't agree, but there was something to shoot at.
Mm.
You know, something to look at. And so I give Mr. Pye, great late Mr. Pye,
yeah,
unfortunately, credit for going that direction. But we did not agree on very much after that. So you can have, the data can be there, but people can kind of disagree. But what will happen is, ultimately, if enough folks look at it, same as the Ketchum data with Bigfoot,
right,
you'll get to a consensus point. And, you know, people will say, no, you know what, that's really stretching it. Or, yeah, that's really on target, but look at this. And that's what we need. That's what the Paracas skulls lack at this stage. We need something on the table to look at. And once we've got that, I agree with you that the judgment can be swift, very swift.
Yeah, I'll get the article here up above that. It was Zane of the Wild Woman. And it was Brian Sykes was doing the research, and found out that it was it had been long thought that she was some kind of domesticated Almasti or Almas, which is like a version of Bigfoot.
Oh, okay.
And then it turned out it was a person who was a sub-Saharan African.
Okay.
So sounds like,
yeah,
this all went down in like the 19th century, so there's a lot of weird issues, I'm sure, afloat in that whole story.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
The older some of the remains are and the more hands that they pass through, that also complicates things.
Mm.
If I had to pick a project, I would never have picked the Star Child, for example, to work on because it's so technically difficult. And, you know, to get anything out of that at all was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, it's the Bigfoot, I presume the Paracas skulls, if and when we see something, will go pretty fast.
Now,
go
ahead.
No, I was going to say that if you recall also this over the last year, the Atacama humanoid Dr. Greer, that had a pretty short half-life once Dr. Gary Nolan from Stanford University got on board.
Yeah.
And the idea that entity was from another world didn't last very long at all. And that is interesting, but you can see that the half-life of ideas now, if there's testable material, can be very, very short.
Right, right. Well, the question I had, I was talking to Greg Bishop about this on the Year in Review show, and I knew I had to ask you this eventually, because I saw this article. You may have seen it. I thought I sent it to you. It was a while ago, so we both probably going to be foggy about this. But it was about, like, an artist who could take the DNA off of discarded chewing gum and make faces somehow out of it.
Sure, so they say.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, that was my question. Like, how come, because I don't know anything about DNA, really, which I'm sure is a surprise to the listeners. So, like, what are the limitations of what we can do with it? Because you hear all these people, they say they have, like, Bigfoot DNA or whatever. There's not, like, any machine. You can just take the DNA, take the Bigfoot hair or whatever, put it in something and then have it spit out a little miniature model of whatever it came from, right? Or can you, or is there a way to do that?
Well, we can do a lot of things. The term people would use is in silico, which means computer simulation.
Hmm.
And the idea of the face, for example, from the DNA sample is an interesting and I would say great gross overextension of what really can be done reliably with a DNA sequence. And the reason is not that you can't deduce a lot. I mean, we can figure out hair color. You know, some of those properties are fairly straightforward. But to take and say, okay, this is what the person will look like, we're not at that stage yet, and we're not going to be for quite a while. And the reason is that the DNA sequence is a map of potentials and probabilities and possibilities. What actually gets put out there, what actually gets created, is dependent very much on the environment that the infant or whomever is raised in and held in, you know, what mom was like, all those things during pregnancy, for
yeah.
example, have a great effect and impact. So you could think of a real simple example would be that you might have the genetic capability of being 6 feet 4 inches tall, but if you aren't fed the right diet as a kid, if you're starved, for example, you're not going to reach that height. You're not going to attain your genetic potential.
Yeah.
And so we would misread that completely in the skeleton if we got a fragment. We go, oh, this guy was big, and I had potential to play in the NFL, and we'd be wrong.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. So they just don't – they just, yeah, I guess I see what you're saying because it's like a blueprint, as they all say about the DNA. So it's just the basic what could happen.
What could happen. And what does happen can be – Rather different. And even things that we can't get a handle on, like stress, for example, can have an impact on how you kind of turn out.
Yeah.
The strangest one of all to think about is in the process of how things impact DNA without really being written in is epigenomics. One of the strangest things is that what happened to your father and perhaps his father happens to you. It's passed down through these modifications and other things through the generations. And those are not directly readable in the basic sequence. You would miss them. You'd have to look at them in a different way.
What are these? Give me an example, I guess.
One of the things that is interesting is for diethylstilbestrol, if a mother had been exposed to that during pregnancy, her child, for example, might have a higher risk of cancer later in life. And it was partially, I believe, I'm correct on this, have to have your listeners check me, that it was partially due to modifications passed down through the generations and then from that child to the next generation.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I mean, it's really quite fascinating. If people are interested, they can look up epigenomics, and then you can find out, or epigenetics. And what it is a modification of the genome, not really a change in the DNA sequence, but a modification in the genome that would lead to things like gene expression pattern changes that are somewhat heritable, actually sometimes very heritable. And so we can have these things pass through that we can't read in the standard way. When we read the book of the genes.
That's
so,
really strange.
Yeah. So,
wow.
You know, I mean, if your family, for example, had been farmers and exposed to pesticides, we could have standard DNA damage, but we might also have a raft of DNA gene expression changes that are also being passed right along. So that's kind of funky.
Yeah, that is weird. Okay. So we can't just take a piece of Bigfoot hair and like put it in a machine and get a little mini Bigfoot model.
Yeah, or see what he would look like, for example. We could make an approximation. So I think, you know, the most you could say is, yeah, you could draw a picture and maybe get some information in terms of bone structure or whatnot. Assuming all factors were kind of equal, this is how we think it might play out. But beyond that, it's not like you're going to pick him out of a lineup
yeah,
and go
exactly.
back to a yearbook from 1880 and go, that's him. Sorry.
We'll break from tradition a little bit here because we've got a caller on the line. We almost never get a caller this early in the show. So let's bring them on the deck here and see what they have to say. It could be somebody. Sometimes they call in just to listen because they can't get access to the computer. So we'll try them here because they've been on hold for 10 minutes. So if they're trying to get in and talk, I'd feel bad keeping them on hold for much longer. So let's see what's going on. 518 area code. What's your name and what's your question, my friend?
Hi, this is John.
How you doing? Hello? John? What's going on, buddy?
Hi.
Do you have a question for Dr. Tyler Cook, John?
Yes, I do. It's in regards to the Paracas skulls.
Mm-hmm.
I had a question in regards to, I wrote this a while ago, but I never had a chance to, Dr. Cook, John.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see. It's in regards to gene mutation, in regards to adaptation to body modification, like the cradle boning that's done, that possibly was done to the Paracas skulls. And I just wanted to know if that cradle boarding could be passed on through over time.
Interesting.
I'm sorry if I'm babbling here. I'm just trying to read.
I think we get your question. Yeah, it's
okay. So I have a dog who has a it's a toy rat terrier, and it has a short tail. And I was told to the breeder that it was done through over years of modification how they bob the dog's tail. And I did a search on the web about that. It's called T-box transcription factor T gene, and supposedly over time that occurs, you know, like in the litter that the dog was in, six of the dogs had long tails, but our dog had the short tail. And I just want to know, is that possible to happen? You know, is that just a fallacy, or could that be why the Paracas skulls, like over time, cradle boarding, could that be passed on?
We got you.
I'm sorry if I'm babbling.
It's okay. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. You're doing great. Tyler, what do you think of that? That's an interesting question.
It's a good question, and it's something that geneticists have struggled with for quite a while, ever since the time of a guy named Lamarck, when we were trying to figure out how hereditary factors actually worked. One of the questions, and one of the experiments done, by the way, was to whack off the tails of mice and then see if the next generation had short tails or shorter tails or whatnot.
Hmm.
The weakness in those studies is that you get tired and you only do a limited number of generations. In terms of the Paracas skulls, I guess you'd have to go back and see if you could establish a lineage and find out. I mean, this is the difficulty, is that we're looking at everything backwards now.
Right.
And to my knowledge, the tradition has died out. I don't know that anybody does that anymore, but maybe I'm wrong. But the way you could ask that question is to simply try to trace back to the generations and establish whether they had to do any of the actual confinement of the cranium or if they actually stopped or not. My suspicion, and it's just a suspicion, it's just an opinion, is that probably this is not inherited in a standard way. In other words, that if you wanted to have a kid with that cranium, you'd have to deform it yourself, would be my guess.
Hmm.
But the way to go about it, and I think the really logical way, is just to say, well, let's test it out. Let's see what data we can get. Now, we're not going to do the experiment on any kids, but maybe we could find an animal model.
Oh, God. All right.
No, but I mean, this is what I'd say.
I just feel bad for the animal. That's all.
That's the hard part about animal research.
Hmm.
But one of the things we were talking about is the epigenetic, the epiphenomenon of the genome, where it's modified as a consequence of environmental conditions and behaviors of parents, and those are passed on. Those are actually not the standard genes that we've thought about, you know, in the classic way. And so some of the things that were dismissed, that Lamarckism was absolutely dismissed, are kind of coming back now, in a sense, as we found out more about how you really can have sort of heritable patterns that aren't really in the encoded in the sort of the standard way of the DNA sequence, which is really quite interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Although what you're talking about sounds more chemically influenced, and what John's talking about is
physical.
Physical, right?
Physical.
So yeah,
that's
on the track was even possible.
Well, I'd say my instinct would be, I'd say no, but Tim already put a very fine point on it. The experience that we have is primarily something a little bit different, and not so much, you know, the kind of thing that you're talking about. And that's where I'd say that we need to really kind of look at other evidence. If we could establish lineages and records, but I don't think those are going to be very easy to do.
Yeah.
Just based on the situation. And then failing that, then you can fall back on saying, well, we could maybe try some experiments. But you just have to be careful in general that you don't dismiss things too fast, in that, you know, my experience is X, Y, or Z, therefore what you have to say is my hypothesis is.
Hmm.
But that's subject to criticism and experimental verification.
Okay. All set, John? How's that for an answer for you, buddy?
Oh, that's fine. I'll let somebody else get on the line, or I'll just listen to you guys converse.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
Thank
good
you.
Question.
Yeah, that was a great question.
Hey, have a good night, guys.
You too.
Good night. Yeah, that's interesting. I would think that if it was something that was, if it could be passed down that way, that it would mess up the whole like childbirthing situation too. Just the baby's head would be all misshapen, and maybe he would die in childbirth. And so who knows?
You would, again, another great observation. You would have to do it the right way. You know, if you kept the dimension narrow, but I don't know how that would work in utero, because it's a very fairly tight fit there.
Yeah.
So that's where I would say that the evidence right now would make me say, no, I don't think so. But, you know, one of the things that could be done is to look at it and, you know, at least ponder it. There's no harm in that.
Now, looking at one of your articles here on Jeremy's blog here, and I'm not sure if I said it right or not. It's J-Vay. I might have called it Vay-Jay. I sometimes do that, much to his chagrin. But you have an article here on it says, try a new hypothesis, Sherlock. It's from about a couple months ago. And you say ufology's greatest failing is a persistent and almost universal studied indifference toward, getting hard evidence, it says. Multiple opportunities to obtain hypothesis-confirming hard evidence have been and continue to be ignored. What are these opportunities, I guess, and why do you think they're being ignored?
I can't tell you why people do what they do. I can guess, you know, but and I can have really nefarious plots.
Hmm.
The opportunities that I would say would be people who make talking about alien abductions specifically.
Yeah.
People who have issued claims that they are hybrids between some other world alien and a human being, or their children or grandchildren are some sort of hybrids, and they have knowledge of this somehow. I would say, well, then we're missing an opportunity for a really dramatic revelation. So could the hypotheses, say, of David Jacobs be correct? Those people who are hybrids, if they would come forward, that would not be too difficult for modern genomic protocols to reveal. And if you think about the great example is Dr. Nolan's work with Ada, that beginning within, I think, a matter of weeks, they knew that this thing was not from another world, it was human. And so I would say that the missed opportunities are these claims, and we just have to say that they're claims, that haven't been completely investigated, that could be now. 25 years ago, we couldn't. We didn't have the technology, but a lot of the technology now has raced to the point where it's extremely possible to do these things. And as with Ada, you wouldn't have to necessarily even do the whole thing. just parts of it might suffice.
Yeah, right.
So,
yeah, go ahead.
No, the importance of that would be, in my view, and the huge missed opportunity, I think, with alien abductions is to bat down some of the hypotheses that don't work.
Mm, right.
I'm not going to say, therefore, the entire abduction phenomenon is invalidated. Not at all. I want to be very clear that we still do not understand what the basis of these reports would be. But what's important to do is to have hypotheses and then examine them. And that's where we've had the great disconnect, that we've had people that I've criticized very heavily, David Jacobs being one of them, who create ornate theories that they never really check when, in fact, they could. And if your hypothesis is wrong, no matter how beautiful it is, it's wrong, and we need to work elsewhere. And I think, honestly, one of the great tragedies of abduction research is that it's been sort of stymied because we can't get past what I consider to be extremely weak hypotheses that have become accepted as dogma and are repeated over and over again instead of trying new things and looking at the phenomena in new ways.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's ufology's problem as a whole. It's a mess. And I know, like you were saying, you didn't want, you can't really put yourself into the mind of these folks who don't want to test the stuff. And part of it is, I think, and I have this in the notes here, it's sort of like ufology and the paranormal in general are weird, sort of, obviously it's weird, but it's even more troubling in a sense when you look at it as a research community, because it's sort of like entirely driven by the unknown. By the tantalizing unknown in a different sort of way than other sciences are. Do you know what I mean? It's like with other sciences, you're trying to understand things, but you're working towards, you have to work towards getting grants and stuff like that. With ufology, it's like you need to kind of keep amping up the mystery in order to generate the interest and the money to keep it going. You follow me?
I do, and I think you're absolutely correct that one of the things that becomes very important is the next story, the next new story, the continuing of the, whatever you want to call it, the saga, for example, rather than, as you point out, trying to solve something or reach a point where you can have the point, the road forks and you can go a different direction. The other thing that's quite striking is that in more mainstream science, you have the competitive aspect that I don't feel is here in, we'll just pick on abduction research, mm-hmm. in that particular little subgenre, that everybody seems to have kind of divided up into small market niches, whereas in more mainstream science, you've got to pick up the sharpest tools. If there's a gene analysis tool and you're not using it, your grant's never going to get approved.
Yeah.
They're going to go, dude, why are you interviewing patients or hypnotizing them when, in fact, you could do these two tests and be done with it and move on? And it's just such a different world. And that's not the fault of the investigators. I mean, we have the advantage of grant money in mainstream research that these people in abductology don't. You know, they kind of have to find a way. But in terms of what they're doing, it's really oftentimes a pale imitation of real science, and that's a sad state. And I think, again, it's led to the complete sort of, I guess, entrapment of the field in a little circle, and it can't get out of it. And we can't really get anywhere if we just do the same things over and over again, not when there's new tools that would enable somebody to do a little bit more.
Exactly, and I think it adds to this sort of disingenuous feel to the entire field of paranormal research, where it's like you can't. It feels more like you're being conned. At least that's how I feel a lot of times, where I'm not really getting a straight answer because it's important that I don't get a straight answer, so I continue to keep coming back for more information.
It could be. Again, we don't know what's in the hearts of the investigator. And the other thing that to keep in mind is, I don't have any knowledge as to whether some of them actually haven't gone ahead and done the testing.
Mm.
I mean, this is a possibility that they have the data and for whatever reason are not ready to publish it yet. We just don't know. But I think in some instances, people are well-meaning but don't really know what's going on. And so that it's not really a nefarious thing on their part. It's more of don't realize what can be done. And I'll just say that I've heard people on shows, Future Theater, with Bill and Nancy Burns, mm-hmm. where the person came out and said, yeah, I'm a hybrid, I'm a breeder, and this, that, the other thing has happened to me, and claiming modifications to the genome, and I'm going, well, there are some simple tests.
Mm.
And I just don't think that they understood that. And really, if you work backwards and you think that if they really had true intent to deceive, they wouldn't have said that if they knew what the real story was.
So right,
either
right.
they've made a colossal error
mm.
or have no idea what's going on or maybe a little bit of both. Hard to tell. But,
yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I wasn't necessarily saying that everyone is trying to pull the wool over everyone's eyes.
Right.
It's almost, I think it's like an institutionalized issue. In a sense, where the entire research field has become more of a business that's driven by propagating the myth or propagating the mystery, excuse me, and then rather than driving towards solving the mystery.
I think you're right. We just happen to have the same opinion here, but if you go back and you want to look at it a little bit more objectively, you can follow the trajectory of some of the investigators over time. And you can see how the stories have built. Think about the indigo children and the different waves of I forget what they're termed, the different levels of indigo children. I'm not using the right term now.
Yeah, I'm vaguely familiar with the indigo children, but I've just shake my head at the whole
yeah,
concept.
Yeah, if you have, if it doesn't work for you, it really doesn't work for you, but... for people that feel that it explains things about their children, for example, I'm sure it could be very powerful inducement to listen further. But as with David Jacobs, Bud Hopkins, and I think with the Indigo people, Dolores Cannon and is it Mary Rodwell? I'm not sure if I remember the names properly.
There's a whole bunch of folks pushing Indigo children nowadays. Yeah.
And the stories kind of grow with time.
Mm.
And so I think, that would be an objective measure that would kind of bolster your idea that, yeah, it's about the next story. It's about building. And if you notice, they do, in a way, kind of build, which is any good narrative would. And, you could come back and say, yeah, but, look, they have to, dude, because we're finding out more information and everything's consistent. And what I'm not sensing is, anything other than building a narrative in terms of building a narrative and not really checking it in the way that a scientist might or
right.
confirming it in a way that a scientist might.
And in defense of the field now, I'm going to completely turn around here because we're getting super meta on this, but that's why I wanted to have you on the show because I like talking to you about this kind of stuff where we can look at it, from a broader perspective. I thought you were going to say something else when you said when you sort of put yourself in the shoes of the researchers there and you were like, hey, it keeps changing. There's also the whole issue of, like, there's no money or anything. This has to be – there are no grants given for paranormal research, really. I mean, there probably are some small sort of grants and some folks are working toward their doctorate under some kind of paranormal umbrella, but it's very, very small. But aside from that, it has to sort of it kind of has to fund itself in a way.
It does. It does, and that can create its own unique set of pressures.
Right, exactly.
So, unless you have someone like Lawrence Rockefeller, a Bigelow, for example, who's willing to underwrite, you're out there on your own, and you've got to come up with something saleable or at least a concept. Now, we have Kickstarter where you could ask for money to move forward, but it does complicate the situation, and I think there's a perverse incentive to build stories that maybe aren't there. But let me just point out that mainstream scientists also build up tout, trumpet their own results, and sometimes far more than they should.
Mm.
So a great example is in the Alzheimer's field, and I think today there were two things on Twitter about amazing new possible, could be, I don't know, maybe cures for Alzheimer's disease. And yeah, you know what? If you squint your eyes and you look at it and don't think about it too much, and maybe if that animal works just like a human, we got it.
Yeah.
But it's a game. It's a game. And even the mainstream scientists will play it to some extent as well.
I can see that. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Well, if you don't do it, Tim, you don't get the attention, and you don't draw the accolades, and you need that. You need the approval of your peers, and it really doesn't hurt to have the New York Times take interest in your studies and write that up.
Oh, yeah, I can totally see that, yeah.
Oh,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're driven kind of by the same motivators as the paranormal in a way, but it's just more accepted, I guess, more mainstream.
Some of the pressures are remarkably similar. I think that the parameters of behavior, I think, are a little bit different in that there's a line that mainstream scientists won't cross. Or if one of the things, if you see them in an interview, you can start to tell they'll go, well, you know, we have to step back and consider this in a broader context. That usually means the reporter or someone is pushing them to a point that they want a conclusion that the scientists can't comfortably reach.
Yeah, yeah. They want them to speculate or something like or to confirm the reporter's speculation or something.
Exactly,
yeah.
And be more concrete.
Mm.
And a great example of where we've had problems with that has been with climate change research, where, you know, people will come out and say, yeah, you know, hot summer, that definitely means global change is here, and then somebody else will come back and say, hold it. It's more complicated than that. And so when you start to see the scientists or hear the scientists qualify, it usually means they've reached the discomfort zone.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard that very frequently with paranormal work.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I was just going to say that. You don't hear – usually it's the opposite. Usually they're sort of – they love that kind of thing, and they'll keep it going for a while. So it's – you know. But I don't mean to rip on the paranormal, because I love the paranormal, and I find it to be fascinating. I just wish it was more – I just wish it worked better, I guess is the best way to put it. I just don't feel like it's really – I just don't feel like the process is working very well, if that makes any sense.
It has some challenges, let's put it that way. But I look at it in the same way, but I'll also say, but yet, you know, there are people out there who are willing and are trying to do the right things. And one of the things that happens, I feel, is that people are interested. They're not necessarily well-grounded in scientific investigations. This is kind of an esoteric art itself.
Mm.
And they go out and they do things, and they learn about controls and interpretation sort of the hard way, kind of slowly, one step at a time. And, you know, so we could say scientifically that's not the best, but I'll just point out that we all start somewhere. And even the red-hot scientists, like somebody like Dr. Gary Nolan, who's superbly accomplished, didn't start out at birth, you know, writing Nobel Prize winning grants. It's a learning process.
Yeah.
And so I'd say we have some hope because there are some people who are willing to learn.
Mm.
And we'll ask you questions, and like John tonight, and say, yeah, you know, let's talk about this or that, or, you know, what could you do, or what are your suggestions? I did communicate with Lloyd Pye a few times before his death, and he at least listened to me. I don't think he liked what I had to say, but, you know, that's for him to decide.
Yeah.
But at least he was willing to entertain some unsolicited thoughts. So I look at it as, yeah, I agree, there are some problems, but as long as people are willing to investigate things that are interesting and try, then at least we have some hope.
Now, I didn't really follow the specifics of the whole the thing with Gary Nolan. Was he? I'm surprised he even got mixed up in an ET situation like that. And was he? you know, how did he feel after the whole thing was all said and done? Because it got a lot of media attention.
It's interesting. Jack Brewer has a blog post on it that he just put up, I think, yesterday or maybe Monday. And this is at the UFO Trail. That's Jack's blog.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent Dr. Nolan some questions. Just exactly that. How did you get started? And kind of how did it go? And my understanding is, overall and in general, Dr. Nolan became aware of the work of ADA somehow and said, hey, I could help, and just volunteered his services, got in touch somehow with Dr. Greer, and I guess he got a response right away, and so they began to communicate and took off from there. In terms of how it's ultimately going to play out, I can't really tell you what the plan is. I understand that a paper is being prepared. It's unclear to me if that paper will deal with strictly the origin of ADA or if there are two papers, because there's something Dr. Nolan apparently is investigating in terms of genetic mutations that could accommodate or to explain the bizarre structure of that guy, because he's very small. And what that will be, I don't know. That's another project that I wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole, because it would be very difficult to, first of all, find unknown mutations. If you found a standard mutation for dwarfism, that would be one thing.
Mm.
But it's going to be a very difficult process. So anyway, there are papers coming out, and how that will play out, how Dr. Greer will be recognized or noted on those, I don't know.
Interesting. Okay, so it's still percolating then.
It is, as I understand it. And you can get the story on Jack Brewer's blog. And he had quite a bit to say about Starchild. And it's interesting that some of his experiences with Mr. Pye were strikingly similar to mine. But anyway, he has some interesting things to say. I think he's a bit like me. It's just somebody that has an innate interest and is open to saying, well, you know what, I'm in a position where I could help. Why don't you let me help?
Yeah.
And so he was able to make a contribution, a fast one.
This is a lot of talk about people. I don't know if we talked about this last time you were on the show, but this always talk about, you know, pressure in the academic community not to get mixed up in all this stuff. Have you ever sort of gotten any pushback, or people just kind of let you do your thing?
I've been very fortunate that my school and colleagues are very supportive. And as more people have found out that I'm interested, I've had one guy who is a really high-powered software engineer, avionics engineer, and then one person who's a scientist have come up and told me about their experiences.
Oh,
because
wow.
they realize that I wouldn't just dismiss them.
Hmm.
And so what you find is that, yeah, in fact, scientists do have paranormal experiences. There's no real stricture from the school with doing these things, provided I follow the rules for work with human subjects and get the proper paperwork filed for receiving samples. They will allow me to do whatever I feel I want to do, provided I conduct myself as a scientist. Now,
right.
I'll just tell you that David Jacobs, I think, got away with quite a bit at Temple.
Yeah.
I have to imagine it's because probably the university didn't know what he was doing, but maybe I'm wrong on that point. That's just my opinion, and obviously others have different opinions as to the value of his work and his conclusions. But no pushback, no problems.
Sounds almost like the opposite in a way.
When I write things for JVay or Jeff Ritzman or with Jack Brewer, those count as public outreach. So they actually say, yeah, as long as you're kind of doing science and showing people, you know, sort of how scientists would approach things, being a good example, I guess.
Mm.
They don't have any problem with it.
That's great. That's really good, yeah. Yeah. Well, we need, like I said, you know, like I said several times talking to you, we need more folks like you who are scientists to get on board with this, at least to say, hey, let's take a look at it. Not to say, oh, this is, I have the answer to all of our problems here, you know. You're not out there going, oh, the aliens are going to cure Alzheimer's. It's
well, and not, neither do we necessarily have any answers to paranormal questions, you know, like what really causes this. A great example being alien abductions. I can bat down, I think, pretty solidly some of the ideas or show where there are huge holes, but that still doesn't explain the phenomenon, nor does it declare that there is no phenomenon. And I don't want people to think that that's the ultimate goal here. That,
right, right.
My perspective, the ultimate goal is to understand and explain, regardless of what it is.
Exactly, so, exactly. It's about trying to figure out the best questions to ask.
Yeah, and then and going out there and finding out. Because, I mean, just like I think you said once, it would be so cool if you know, somebody actually put a net over Bigfoot and dragged it in.
Yeah, be great. Like,
whoa, that was out there the whole time. You know, I mean, so, and I certainly don't, you know, lose any stature by saying Dr. Ketchum didn't have valid sequences, so I don't know what's going on. And if somebody drags one in, I'm going, oh, that is cool. You know, let's have a look at it.
Well, it's a very flummoxing in a way. I mean, I've been looking at all this for like 10 years now and really producing content for like 8. And it's just frustrating that all the mysteries are all the same ever since I was a kid. Nothing, no mystery, no paranormal mystery that I can think of ever has ever been solved in my lifetime that I can, you know, that I can think of. Maybe ball lightning might have been one of them or something like that. That's about it. You know, so.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. You know, since Harry Houdini was thinking of ways to actually send messages back from the other side, it's been something, ghosts and communication with the dead and other things have been part and parcel of human condition forever.
Yeah.
And so we will continue to wonder until we really get something definitive. So I do think not too long ago we were communicating with Lobo and Rogan after they were on your show, and I think that's where Ro had mentioned that they had unfortunately invited a number of people, scientists or academic types, who declined,
Right. Couldn't
even talk to them.
Yeah, they said that on the show, yeah.
That just sets my teeth on edge because that's the exact opposite of what we really need and should be doing. If you won't talk to the public, I think as a scientist you're not doing your job. As an academic, you're certainly not doing your job. And if you look, you see Stephen Hawking, Neil deGrasse Tyson, the other Lawrence Krauss, others out there, high profile scientists who don't need anything from us, who want to come out and talk to us.
Right.
And explain things. And that's what it's all about.
Well, it's, yeah, yeah. The strange and, it's not really unfortunate. I mean, I don't know if, some days I'm on the side of ufology and sometimes I'm not. So it depends on my mood. But the unfortunate part, I guess, is it's all on one side in that equation. You know, the people who there's no one. I guess Michio Kaku might be the best voice we have sort of for the pro UFO side of things. And even he's not really like pushing that they're coming here necessarily.
No, and there are a few. I think Jeffrey Bennett, Bernard Haish, I think scientist out in California,
okay, yeah.
Astronomer. There are a few, and some higher profile than others. Yeah, I mean, we could definitely use a few more.
Always. Let me see here. We got another caller here in the 203 area code, which this may be Lobo himself.
Oh no.
Yeah, I know, and he may also be just listening from work. So we'll bring him aboard here and see what he has to say. I'm pretty sure it's Lobo. Let's see. Hello there, 203 area code. What's your name and where are you calling from?
You hit the nail on the head, brother.
Oh boy.
I'm going home.
Uh-oh, yeah, man. What
Tyler,
are
you
doing?
Love me, you know it.
Are you just listening at work, or do you have a question or a comment?
I'm just listening
the
at the moment, yeah. No, I was told
all
to
right.
call in and harass Tyler, but I love Tyler, so I don't think I can harass him.
Yeah, I posted on Twitter. I was afraid you guys would come in and start talking about heavy water. Okay? Not a subject to be taken lightly, mister.
No, I don't know what heavy water. I'm out of the loop on this.
Oh, these guys are totally lost it.
Yeah, they're a strange pair, those two. They're a strange pair.
Yeah.
Last time I talked to them, I was in bad shape myself, so I barely survived. But
yeah,
all right, Lobo, do you have anything else to throw into the mix here? So far in the conversation,
I'm
going to
listen for now. I guess I can hit the number one if I want to bug you again, right?
I suppose I have no idea what it does, but I'll put you. I'm like a chimp here behind these controls, so I will. I'll put you back on the show. Exactly. I'll put you back on mute, and you can keep listening in on our conversation. All right.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks for calling,
Take
Lobo.
Care.
Thank you,
no
Lobo.
Problem, sir.
Enjoy the show.
No problem. Yeah. Thanks.
That's a good, actually, kind of segue, because I can jump from there into something completely different. So thank you to Lobo, sort of a little break for us. Have you ever, I presume you've looked at this, at least considered it, let's say that, because it makes it sound like you've actually done any research, and you may not have, but what's your take on this autism and just the sheer wave of autism that's sort of picked up in the last, like, 15 years, and how it's become this really prevalent affliction that is very, very mysterious?
This is one of the things that people have talked about in terms of evidence and how we parse evidence. And you often hear that, well, this is all anecdotal. It's all anecdotal. It's not important. But in actual fact, these stories, the clinical histories and whatnot of autism and diagnosing it more frequently are very troubling.
Hmm.
And often this is the first way that problems come to the fore. And so it has people really scratching their heads. And one of the things that you're probably aware of is one of the first things that people sort of latched onto as an explanation was vaccinations.
Yes.
And measles, mumps, and rubella, MMR in particular. And what was noted was a very striking correlation that about the time the kids were receiving their first MMR vaccine, the autism began to take hold.
Right. That's like a huge debate in the, you know, it's a huge debate in the mainstream now at this point,
absolutely.
The vaccine issue. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so the people have looked at this in every possible way to try to figure out, you know, what in heck, is there a correlation? And these are not easy studies to do. They're really difficult. When you get to something that is as prevalent as 1 in 150 or maybe even lower now in terms of autism, wow, I mean, those can correlate with a large number of things. And one of the problems and one of the real difficulties here is that a correlation is not necessarily equivalent to a cause. It can be, but it's not necessarily. And so you've got to tease this all out.
Mm.
And we had some setbacks. I don't know if you're aware of Andrew Wakefield, who did a study that was spectacular. It was touted, but it was possibly, well, it's thought to be wrong and even criminally so. He's lost his medical license, as I understand it.
Oh, boy.
That led to a huge concern about MMR vaccines. And those issues go on. Looking at the vaccine, though, is very important, and people have tried exhaustively, really,
yeah,
to figure out what's going on. And one of the things that you have that is more than a little bit scary is that this vaccine, MMR, and there are a few others, is actually alive. You're giving kids an infection with the viruses,
yeah,
measles, mumps, and rubella, very attenuated viruses, and they should induce immunity without causing too much trouble, but not everyone can have this vaccine. So if there's any kind of immune problem, immune suppression, something along those lines, they can't have this. They can't receive it. They can never receive it because it could be dangerous to them. So it's true in one way. I'm not saying that MMR, my personal read of the data is we have not established MMR is a risk for autism. That's my looking at the data. But when we think about these things, you always have to understand that any time you take a treatment, take an aspirin, this is not risk-free, that something could go wrong. And but we've had so much controversy over MMR in particular, and one of the more disappointing things from my standpoint is that when scientists began to say, think pretty much in general agreement, that MMR was not a cause of autism, the argument would shift. And then they'd say, well, no, it's the thimerosal, the thimerosal.
Yeah.
And that's a preservative that we put in the vaccines so that they don't basically get infected with something before you inject them into a kid.
Yeah.
MMR and the live attenuated have never had thimerosal. Never. You can't put them in there. It would inactivate the viruses that you need to be alive.
Huh.
It was not a feature. And so then when that argument was quickly batted down, the next one was, well, you know what, it's a totality. There are other vaccines, pediatric vaccines, that have thimerosal in them. That was true, and that was looked at. And what the medical community did is they squeezed down the amount of thimerosal, and I think the only vaccine routinely used in the pediatric population today that has it is flu vaccine taken from a multi-use vial, which means we practically have none of that in kids, and the rate of autism continues to climb. That is a very strong case against thimerosal ever causing this problem.
Yeah.
But you'll see it out there in the internet. Stuff never dies.
It keeps coming back
over and over again.
Yeah.
So,
plus, then you get, you know, the whole thing, too, is everyone gets on that, the actress there, Jenny McCarthy, because she's, I don't know if she still backs the whole vaccination theory or what, but it's, then people get upset with, people, you know, get the wrong information and then get spread out there by celebrities and stuff. It's a mess.
Especially in
the medical field, you know, because the next thing you know, parents aren't giving their kids vaccines, and then there's outbreaks of the measles and the mumps and stuff.
We've had a bad couple of years in the U.S. and the United Kingdom in particular with measles finding unvaccinated individuals, not always children.
Mm.
And measles and chickenpox are about the most infectious agents out there, and they will find you. And this is one of the worries that medical professionals have, is that if we don't keep really good coverage with measles, it will find the kid that for very valid medical reasons could not be vaccinated and perhaps create havoc. And the problem with measles is that we have no good way to combat it once it gets you. It's all about prevention.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, I mean, Ms. McCarthy has changed her idea about what her son's malady was and how it was cause, but it's hard to pull this back. And the same thing with Andrew Wakefield, that his study was scientifically discredited, but it's hard to put that back into the bottle and cork it that people believe, and this is unfortunate.
Yeah. Looking at an article here, it says contractions of measles, potentially deadly, imminently preventable measles, are increasing logarithmically in the United States, and they are at a 20-year high. So.
Yeah, we've had a bad year. The other thing that is really kind of interesting, it hasn't received much play yet, is that the vaccine, the MMR vaccine, we were routinely giving two administrations, one around age two, one right before the entry of school, so 4 to 6, and that was it. And we're not sure that that's adequate.
Mm.
And if you searched there's a very interesting case. I think it was referred to by this on the Google search engine as Measles Mary. And this person was vaccinated, got measles, and we always assume that if they had, it's called breakthrough, they had a breakthrough case, they couldn't produce enough virus to infect anybody. Well, Measles Mary got two people, at least. Actually, I think she got four. Two of them came down with it really good.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Googled it just now. That's weird.
So one of the things that's happening is we do have to follow these events and realize that stuff in medicine is not necessarily perfected. It's best use or considered best use, but we do find out that, you know, well, maybe this MMR, it is a natural infection, sort of, and maybe it's not going to give us the lifelong protection that we had hoped for. So,
well, is it the kind of thing like, this is like a hypothetical scenario, but like, I guess everybody gets the polio vaccine now, right?
Yes.
Like if someone wasn't given the polio vaccine and then they got polio, could it like mutate into a version that isn't covered by the vaccine and then cause a huge outbreak?
It's, I haven't heard of that particular scenario.
Yeah.
What does happen is something actually amazingly similar in that probably at your age, you got the oral polio vaccine. And what we did is we did away with the it's called OPV, oral polio vaccine,
yeah,
in the U.S. because about 10 to 12 people each year were being paralyzed by the as a consequence of the vaccination.
Jesus.
And what would happen was the virus would replicate in them. It's a natural infection in the baby, usually still in diapers, and they would produce a lot of virus, but the virus would mutate. So the benign vaccine strain turned into a paralyzer. And the caregivers of these infants, who we didn't realize were not protected, perhaps they'd immigrated, perhaps their medical records weren't so good, they were getting the infection, and they were being paralyzed. And so what they did is they switched over to the inactivated polio vaccine, which you get as a shot.
Yeah.
And that will protect, provided it's properly made, without causing any risk of this sort of vaccine-associated paralytic polio. But it's kind of the scenario I think you're talking about, is that the virus itself does mutate. It does change. And it does things that we didn't think it could do. The IPV is pretty good at protecting you from disease, but it's not particularly good at stopping the virus from circulating.
Mm.
And so we've had the, you know, the little thing out there in nooks and crannies, and it's hard to find and very elusive. And thought we had it tracked down, almost had it wiped out, we thought. And war in Afghanistan and instability in other places has kind of led to a resurgence of polio.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, yeah.
Jesus.
But not the least of which, there is resistance to vaccine programs even in places like Pakistan. And it's not because of Jenny McCarthy. It's other factors. But I don't know if you heard about the CIA attempted to locate Osama bin Laden with a fake vaccine program.
Oh, really? No, I never heard that. Wow.
Yeah, they had traced him down, I guess, to Abbottabad, where they ultimately found him. And so the question became, was he really in there? And they figured out that one way to answer that would be to have someone come and vaccinate the local people in the house, knowing that they moved in, or that would be the pretext. And when they did that, they would withdraw a little bit of blood in the syringe and take it away. And then somebody could do a DNA analysis, because they did have knowledge of Osama bin Laden's profile, familial profile, and try to figure out if one of those were his children.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that got found out. That program was discovered, and the Pakistanis took a very dim view of it. I believe the doctor is still imprisoned, but it becomes one of those things that, see, the CIA, you know, the classic sort of myth or legend that the CIA is doing X, Y, or Z, including trying to kill people or whatnot. It's not really a vaccine program. It's really a genocide program. That doesn't help matters.
Yeah.
Okay, so Yeah. And I guess President Obama has issued a decree that they won't do that anymore. So.
Oh, great. Yeah. Who knows? I mean, I don't believe anything the government says anymore, so.
Yeah, sound advice.
Yeah, well, they said they just shut down HAARP, but I don't know if they really did or not. I can't get up to Alaska and check.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It can be difficult to verify some of these assertions. But
well,
anyway, that program
didn't.
Well, it would have been great if nobody found out about it, but that cat got out of the bag. So
I feel bad for the guy who was in jail.
Yes, yeah. So
he was just
I don't know how that will play out, but all I can tell you is don't let your kids work for the CIA would be my advice.
Good advice. we talked last week to set this up, this show, and you sent me an email that you had written an article regarding mad cow disease and stuff like that, and you said that there was some stuff you hadn't mentioned about prions and mad cow disease in our food supply that the audience might find unsettling, which is always a good sign. So what's...
Well, I wrote a review of Christopher O'Brien's book, Stalking the Herd.
Yeah.
And it was for Rogin and Lobo, which they posted on their Project Archivist website very kindly. So... In the book, I had a few comments about, I applaud Mr. O'Brien's enthusiasm. I think scientifically he kind of missed the mark.
Mm.
But, you know, for, again, people that aren't really necessarily scientifically well-trained or whatever, some of these things about controls and data and methods, they can be elusive. And so I think maybe, you know, next time around the book will be more forthcoming as to methods and whatnot. But one of the things that was very interesting is that they couldn't reach any conclusion, or I shouldn't say they. I believe he's working with a gentleman whose last name is Perkins. And I don't know him at all. But the problem with the mad cow thing is, why would someone do these things? Are they extraterrestrials? Is it a government program? And I think Colm Kelleher has sort of hypothesized a long time ago that this was a project, really, the cow mutilations, the dead cows laying around and stripped of certain organs, was really a project done at the behest of the government to figure out were prions getting into the human food chain.
Yeah.
And I don't feel – my personal take is the way that Mr. O'Brien described – and again, it was pretty minimal. A lot of case histories, mind-numbing amounts of case histories.
Yeah.
But not a whole lot of specific data. But what was done, I don't think comports with what someone would do if they were really gunning – for mad cow prions. But anyway, prions are infectious proteins, and they will basically cause spongiform encephalopathy, Swiss cheese of the brain.
Yeah.
And lethal. Where they've been most notorious is mad cow disease in Great Britain. And about 25 years ago, there was a massive epidemic of mad cow disease, and quite a number of cattle had to be slaughtered. We think... The evidence suggests that some of these mad cow prions got into humans through dietary practices. So we ate hamburgers, for example.
Yeah.
Some people even eat beef brains and thymus.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah. Still, to this day. But
no, that
anyway.
Makes sense, actually. Yeah, I can. They eat all kinds of strange things. They, you know, all kinds of strange things. I don't need to go into
Well,
that.
Back in the day, yeah, brain was considered to be quite a nutritious. I don't really like the organ meat stuff, to me they always taste kind of rusty.
Hmm.
But anyway, the mad cow disease prions were certainly in cattle because we made cattle into cannibals. We started feeding back parts. When you slaughter the animal, they put it up on basically a kind of a rolling dolly, and everything that falls off of the carcass onto the floor into a chute is called offal.
Yeah.
And that is oftentimes ground up and put into other things,
sausages and hot dogs and stuff like that, you mean?
Yeah. And some of the really foul stuff is... Well, anyway, it...
You should save this for the 4th of July episode. It would be good timing for your barbecuing, folks.
the parts that really didn't go anywhere, weren't very saleable, were being recycled back to the cows.
Oh, boy.
And they put it back in their feed, including blood, believe it or not.
Oh, God.
And the cows would eat it. Okay, but what happened is prions form in our brain spontaneously at a low rate. And we think that just like happened with the Foray-speaking people, the Kuru, got into them because of cannibalism. We had the mad cow epidemic getting cows, and perhaps it looks like very likely leaped into humans as a consequence of humans eating cow parts. So there's always been a worry about these things. Now, Great Britain suffered tremendously, and their beef industry was decimated.
Yeah.
The U.S. never had quite the problem because we didn't do the I would call it hardcore refeed like they did in Great Britain. But nonetheless, there is an interest in prions in the food supply. And Kelleher is correct in one thing. I don't agree with any of his interpretations, but he got one thing right. There is a government interest in prions. And in fact, there's a formal program to sample, to see, to be sure that prions aren't getting into cows. And we've had a few instances where cows with mad cow disease have been discovered. They have. There is absolutely no doubt. They have been discovered in the U.S. And so, but very few, not the many, many thousands in Great Britain. So the idea of black helicopters, somebody sampling, that's actually kind of intriguing and has a little bit of a solid ring to it. I don't believe that's what has been demonstrated. In fact, I'm sure that the evidence that Mr. O'Brien brought forth does not demonstrate that, but perhaps the next book he will.
Yeah.
And so, but there really are programs to take a look.
Well, I'm sure if they wanted to figure it out, they don't want to freak everybody out. I mean, so they would do it kind of under the cloak of clandestine nature, right?
Well, there's been quite a bit of argument during the Bush administration, for example, like how many animals would it take to sample in order to figure out what was going on. And that's the power of statistics, is that you can do a lot with relatively few. And I'm not sure if there's a move afoot to stop the program or not. But it might interest you to know that a company that wanted to sample every cow and would be able to certify, we have examined every animal, and these animals are BSE-free. Or they couldn't really say that, but they could say below the limit of detection.
Right, right.
That's not permissible.
It's not allowed.
No, it's actually the prions, the pathologic prions, in one sense, are a little bit like radioactivity.
Yeah.
In that if you look hard enough and carefully enough, you're very liable to find it. And if you do, even though they're at ungodly low levels, for example,
mm-hmm.
it could create problems if you had a positive test. Even a false positive could kill you. It could decimate the industry because countries would say, no, we don't want your beef. You know, it's full of mad cow, which is not even close to the point. But
right.
It could create a lot of issues.
Jesus.
So, yeah, people do look. They really do look. So... Do you think they should?
Look for the mad cow? Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course.
You feel safe, punk?
I never feel safe. You know me. You know about my life. It's fraught with dangers and strangeness. So.
We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?